is Mario Valencia. I represent the appellant, Alexander Kostyukov, in this case. And if it's okay, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
We'll try to help you, but please watch the clock.
Well, there. So, in this appeal, we're asking the court to reverse and vacate Mr. Kostyukov's sentence and remand for resentencing because the district court miscalculated the guidelines. That's procedural error. And we believe it's deserving of a remand because it affected his substantial rights, and the court did not in any way, shape, or form indicate that he would have imposed the sentence that he did, regardless of what the guideline calculations would be.
I'm sorry to interrupt you so early.
That's okay.
I've done your job too. But I'm a district judge, and I get every time I look at one of these, I try to see what the district judge did wrong. I mean, that's sort of, if I was there, would I recognize there's something wrong? And I've looked at the transcript, page 9 through. I'm supposed to think it is. And if you look at that, the government first does this calculation of the guideline, and it says it's 40, and then it explains why it's 40. And then it says that it summarizes why they believe these enhancements should be applied. And then it asks the defense counsel for his comments. And the defense counsel says that he agrees that the offense level is 40, agrees with the presentation made by the government as to the enhancements. In specific language, we don't take any dispute with that, and agrees to the guideline range, and the government is offered to put more testimony on when it's talking about how to do the calculations. So if I was sitting there, there's no dispute about this. This man is telling me he agrees with the 40 points, he agrees with the enhancements, doesn't have anything to add, he agrees with the guideline range, and he's only talking about what to do with the guideline range. And it seems to me that any argument in front of me would have been waived because I would have said if you're disagreeing with the answer, you might have new witnesses that they're required to come to the stand. So, what should the district have done when you, your prior counsel, says, I don't have any objection to what's been proposed?
Well, there's a lot in that question. So, let me start out by saying that it's true that he did not object to three of the enhancements that we are challenging upon appeal. We're challenging four of the enhancements that were imposed, loss amount in the range of $50.8 million. There was also a six-level enhancement that was applied because the court said there was substantial financial hardship to 25 or more victims. Then he applied a leadership role adjustment. He added two levels for being a leader, organizer, manager. And then he added two more levels on top of that for being in the business of receiving and selling stolen property. So Kostyukov objected to the first one at the time that he was pleading guilty, which was the loss amount.
He didn't object to the sentencing, though.
He did not. That's absolutely true. And he did not put in his sentencing memorandum that he was objecting to the loss amount. What counsel did, and if you read it, and these are on pages 11 and 12, and just to give a little background on it.
So, I think, could you answer Judge Wade's question about what the judge should have done in light of the fact that there were no objections in the sentencing hearing?
Yes, so just because there's no objection doesn't mean that we can raise certain issues on appeal when there's plain error. So at most, right, under Rule 32, which is one of the positions that the government takes in this case, is that, well, the court adopted, there has to be proof or something to support that enhancement. And so usually when there's no objection, right, you look to the PSR, and you can look to the PSR and say, well, in the PSR, there was evidence to support this enhancement, and the court just adopted the PSR. But there is no evidence for these enhancements in the PSR, so there's no evidence at all.
It's something that's supposed to be, I don't want to give you a fair shot, but
sure,
it happened a lot of times in the district court, is a lawyer will summarize something, and it may not be any other proof. It's a proffer. A proffer would be this. So if you couldn't accept the proffer, you'd have to have something in evidence. But instead, the proffer says, just like he's done here, and he's offered to put on testimony about the agent there. And so the defense counsel then says you don't have to do that. So it seems to me, even if there was no record of the law, lawsuit. But the U.S. attorney outlined what his proffer was his time. And he says, I got a witness to do that. The defense counsel says, you don't need to. I agree with it. I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to put myself in that spot where that district judge was, and I don't know if I said he got to call a witness anyway, because I don't know.
I'm not saying he had to call a witness or whatever.
That is what you're saying. Isn't that what you're saying? You're saying it was plain error for the judge not to require more evidence. I think you are saying that.
I am saying, you're right, Your Honor, I am saying that they had to put on evidence. But here's the sequence of events. So if you give me a fair shot, let me give this a shot. Here's the sequence of events, the way that it happens. Kostyukov was offered 3 plea agreements before he pleaded guilty. He rejected all of them because he was going to dispute the loss amount. It was an astronomical amount, 50.8. It had to do with 3 or 4 other organizations he said that he had nothing to do with. He pleads in like 2013 for 2 years because he cooperated with the government. He was willing to testify at trials if they would come up. That didn't happen. During those 2 years, other people pled guilty and were sentenced. And the court found in those other sentencing hearings that the loss amount was $50.8 million. Counsel, I'll admit it, that this was a mistake on his part. But when he comes into the sentencing, he reminds the court, listen, court, I don't take issue with the government who is now saying that instead of a level 24, it's a level 22 when you're talking about $50.8 million. And he says right in here, we don't take issue with that analysis, the minus 2 levels. But then he reminds the court, if you remember, Kostyukov didn't plead guilty because he was going to dispute the loss amount. But since he's pled guilty, this court has over and over found that it was $50.8 million, the restitution loss. And he mistakenly thinks a restitution loss counts for sentencing purposes loss amount. And then it's not that he's acknowledging or agreeing that $50.8 million is correct. He's just simply waving the white flag and saying it's a moot issue. He was wrong. But he's saying the issue is moot. You've already ruled that, so fine. That's the situation. So it's $50.8 million. That's what happened in this case. He is not in any way, and nowhere in the record does he say, I agree, $50.8 million is the right amount. We don't take issue with that calculation or whatever. He is simply pointing out, look, you've already ruled, and since you've ruled, and it's moot, is what he's thinking. We're not going to go ahead and waste time on those. We'll take our time and address the issues that need to be addressed.
So can you explain why you think any of this would have made a difference, even if we agree with you that one of these was a clear error? It seems like he got such a lower sentence than the guidelines, and the judge was trying to match up to the other defendants. So how can you show that there was an effect on his substantial rights?
Just for example, the following: if you were to take the other three, let's say for loss amount, you just decided, you know what, you're wrong, Mr. Valencia, Mr. Kostyukov, that was gone, it was waived. But just on substantial financial hardship, the stolen property, leadership enhancement, those added up together are 10 levels. Now, according to the government at sentencing, the correct guideline calculation, right, ended up with a total offense level of 40. Okay, if you were to take away those 10 levels, that would be a level 30. Then because he cooperated with the government, the 5K, they asked for 3 more levels off of that. That would bring it down to a level 27. At a level 27, category 1, he was looking at 70 to 87 months. And the sentence that was imposed here was 108 months. Because he was originally looking at like 210 to
240. We've got all of them to get to that.
We do, and we think we have good arguments. Unfortunately, I can't do the rest of it.
Maybe you should save the rest of your time for rebuttal.
Yes, please.
Excuse me. Good morning, Your Honors. Nancy Olson, appearing on behalf of the government. May it please the court, I'd like to address the arguments in the order that they were raised by Mr. Valencia. Starting off, Judge Whaley is absolutely correct in his comments that the district court did not do anything wrong here. There's nothing else that could have been done in light of the record where the defendant either agreed or essentially waived those arguments. Moreover, the guideline calculations were correct. When there's no objection from the defendant, the court can rely on Rule 32 to say that anything in PSR is a finding of fact. And we've cited in our brief different portions of the PSR.
I haven't seen anything in the PSR that addressed substantial financial harm to 25 victims, showing that an actual amount to 25 victims was substantial. Can you address that issue?
Yes, Your Honor. So there is not a paragraph in the PSR that lists out 25 separate financial institutions. That's correct. And so I'd like to draw your attention to what it was the district court had in front of it to make this finding. First paragraph 23, it refers to millions of individual victims and also countless financial institutions.
And how do we know that each of those victims didn't only have an injury of $5?
The district court had in front of it the trial exhibits from Mr. Kamez's trial. This is a co-defendant. And some of those exhibits were detailed spreadsheets that listed out these items item by item.
So do we have those in the record here?
They were not submitted in the appellate record. They were in front of the district court as trial exhibits, admitted in the Kamez trial specifically.
So I could only find, I think, four victims. We have amounts in this record, I think, for four victims that are high amounts. But nothing that I could find on any others. Can you point to anything in our record here that gives us numbers for any other victims?
So we pointed to the Kamez trial transcript because there you have the Visa and MasterCard witnesses testifying, and they're explaining how the loss worked. And they said, we're sort of an upper-level entity that doesn't lose money because we have all those things flowing through us. And so although that they can tell you the overall loss, they don't take the loss. The loss goes to those mid-level merchant banks who have to take the loss.
But for the mid-level banks, I think those would have to be the 25 victims.
Correct.
Do we have anything in the record here that tells us that it's not the case that one of them got the whole loss and all the others got $5?
Just the trial exhibits that were given at the district court. And so
what are we supposed to do here on appeal with not having this?
Well, on plain error review, this court has to look to whether or not there was anything that the district court could have relied upon. And we have these also going to paragraphs 24, 26, and 30 in the PSR. These are sort of the overall paragraphs summarizing the loss, summarizing who was involved, and how we get to the $50.8 million. And so knowing that the district court had in front of him those detailed loss spreadsheets, knowing that he sat through that trial and learned about
the district judge.
That's the same district judge.
So we just have to assume that the exhibits that we can't see had this information?
You have to ask if the judge plainly erred. And so knowing what he had in front of him, in combination with the summaries,
maybe those exhibits showed $5 for every victim and one with a higher one. How do we know that they didn't?
This court does not know because we did not submit those exhibits, and that's correct. But we're looking here at what the district court did with the information in front of him and the lack of objection. And so was there any reasonable basis that this court can say that he plainly erred, knowing that he had that information from trial, knowing that he had...
Well, but isn't it the government's burden to show that the enhancement is justified? And if the government didn't put it into the record in this case, we are really in a problem on appeal, aren't we?
So this is back to the comments that were made earlier about the government making a proffer and saying, here's what we have a witness there that did have Agent Adams sitting there at the time of the sentencing. And because nothing was contested, that's where it stopped. There was no further evidence put on to support any of these because Mr. Kostikoff flat out said that he's not contesting the PSR. The real issue in this case is
kind of a weird situation. So, we have a plain error rule that does let us review things that aren't objected to. Do you think we're in some kind of super plain error here? And is there some case that helps us with this weird situation where I do think it was worse for the government because they said they weren't contesting it, and yet I don't know how that fits with our plain error rule that says we're supposed to review things for plain error?
No, it's not a different rule, Your Honor. It's the normal rule, and so you do have to look at what the district court had in front of it and see if that was sufficient. And so that's even the sake of argument that you say, without those spreadsheets, we can't support this today. So then the next question is Mr. Kostikoff met his burden to show prejudice? And he can't show that on any of these enhancements. And the reason is, if you look at how the sentencing played out, again, his guidelines range was astronomical. We're talking it was 260 with the 5K. It was maybe as low as 210. But the district court essentially set all that aside because he said, look, I have all these co-defendants that have come in front of me and already been sentenced. The government pointed out there was a group structure in place. People were getting sentenced based on their role in this organization. And specifically, Mr. Kostikoff was a vendor. He was offering cash out services. And so the PSR recommended 120 months. And the real dispute amongst the parties and for the court to resolve was how far below 120 months the court should come. And so the government said, we think 120 is too high. We're actually going to argue for 108 with an additional variance. And Mr. Kostikoff obviously argued for lower than that. But the court here said he had to be sentenced. He was very concerned about sentencing disparity. He talked about it in the record all the way from pages 19 through 35. There's district court comments about sentencing disparity and relative culpability, as well as hearing arguments from the parties on this issue. And so with that being the crux of the district court's concern, and rejecting the argument that Mr. Kashukov should get a sentence around 70 months, which would have put him in the territory of a member. A member was the lowest level person in this organization, and he certainly was not in that boat. And so the district court talked.
At one point, the district said one of the differences is you start at a higher level, not just as a vendor, but the extent of your involvement in the operation. What do you think the judge meant by you start at a higher level?
He looked at how much Mr. Kashukov was involved, and so he looked at the number of stolen identities that were on his computer, his stolen credit card information. There were several examples given of how he was doing his cash out.
So you think that wasn't a reference to the guideline range, that the judge was using the guideline range as an anchor? You think it was this just a subjective description of the involvement?
It could have also been referencing the loss, but in any event, that guidelines range was correct, because even if you look at how the other co-defendants were based on plus or minus three years of involvement and so on, even if we said, okay, he can maybe get down to approximately $40 million, it's the same guidelines bracket of $25 to $65 million. And so there's no error there. So when we talk about
his level. Wait, and if he didn't have 25 victims, the range would be lower, right?
That's correct.
The merchant position is he essentially, he was part of this organization. He knew, was familiar with the record in the other case. He knew what was going on. He essentially agreed.
He did, because Mr. Kashukov strenuously argued for this lower sentence, and the court said, I can't do that. It accepted the government's argument, which was, if you sentence him as a member, we have other vendors and higher level people that are still in the pipeline, and they're going to come in here and say, well, this vendor got the same as a member, so I should also get something like 60 months, 70 months, whatever the case may be. And so the district judge did this specifically to keep the group structure in place and to have the relative culpability mean something where Kashukov did have significant involvement.
But with respect to the 25 victims, didn't he in effect agree there were 25, at least 25 that were substantially injured?
Do you mean Mr. Kashukov?
No.
Yes, he did. That's correct. So he did not object to the fact of this.
He just went back to the district judge, but the U.S. attorney said, you remember that Agent Adams testified in the trial there were actually many more financial institutions that suffered a substantial financial hardship, including numerous overseas financial institutions that would require multiple excessive MLATs for us to obtain that result, and that we had chosen not to engage in that activity. Agent Adams has been happy to testify more this morning if he would like to hear more on that issue. So it seems a direct issue of how many banks there were was referenced in the testimony that he had summarized at the trial and they offered to put him on the stand.
That's correct.
I don't know how you could do any more on that except put him on the stand anyway.
What they would have done is put him on the stand and they would have introduced the spreadsheets at this particular sentencing hearing rather than having us simply point back to the chemist trial to sort of recreate, well, what would have happened if there wouldn't have been an objection.
And what do you think substantial means with respect to a financial institution?
If you look at the criteria and the guidelines, they're a little more,
they're about individuals, right?
Correct. So it's things like insolvency and loss of job, having to move, things like that. It's a little bit harder to say because you're going to look at the size of the financial institution, how it affected perhaps revenues, things like that. Do they have to lay people off? I just recently, again, looked for any updated cases on this. It's a relatively new enhancement. I did not find anything, so I don't have a case to point the court to about financial institutions specifically. But we did cite a Seventh Circuit case that talks about individuals and more specifically talks about how district courts really have latitude here to look at whatever they can find in a large record that may or may not bear on this. And so it might have to do with individual victims having to recur their credit and dealing with the stress and the loss and things like that. It might have to do with banks. And so there would be disruption in operations. Certainly there would be a hit to the bank's revenues.
Because these spreadsheets have addressed those issues.
They had line by line the transactions that were fraudulent. They were not particularly sortable by entity, so it would have been more the district court taking the evidence he heard at trial, taking what he knew, Agent Adams, Visa, MasterCard, and everyone testified to, and looking at that volume to indicate whether he had some sort of reasonable basis. And the question here was a plain error rather than, so did he have something, did he have anything he could hang his hat on, versus a complete absence of information in the record, which he did not. So I see my time is about up. The court does not have any further questions.
Thank you, Sylvia.
Thank you.
Again, I'd like to start out just addressing the substantial financial hardship standard changed, and under comment 4 of that guideline, it lists what substantial financial hardship is, some of the factors to consider, and other things. And first of all, in the Canvas trial, Agent, I can't remember his name, he did not testify at all about substantial financial hardship. As we put in our reply brief, and the court read something very important here. It's on page 10, ER page 10. This is the government speaking. They said that they would have required multiple and excessive MLS routes to obtain that result, and we chose not to engage in that activity, meaning they didn't get the evidence to, that they don't have evidence to show exactly how much each bank suffered. So here's the way that it goes. Visa and MasterCard suffered no loss directly. They put in their brief, they had 20,000 banks, and those 20,000 banks, according to them, was a cumulative amount of $4.5 million. When you take 20,000 into $4.5 million, each one of those banks, if each one suffered exactly the same, that's $225 for a bank, a financial institution. That's not a substantial financial hardship. And the court didn't go through and figure out any of those steps for financial hardship.
Do you really think that the counsel could sit there and say, and essentially say, we have no objection, we agree, and then come up on appeal and say, oh, they didn't go through it sufficiently?
I do, Your Honor, because there still has to be support for that enhancement. And the court can't just sit there and say, well, I'll give you another example. On the loss amount, you mentioned, Your Honor, that, well, Kosyukov agreed to everything, so he's entitled, you know, he's responsible for everything. But in reality, he's not, and that's what the guidelines say. The entire scope of the conspiracy isn't exactly what one defendant may have done when he joined a conspiracy. It requires particularized findings. For example, the court made no mistake about it, never made a agreement, that's what Kosyukov pled guilty to. That was that he was only involved in this organization from March 31 of 2008. To June of 2011. The investigation started in 2005 and went to 2012. The loss amounts reported by the only four credit card companies that these guys focused on and the only evidence that they submitted for the $50.8 million loss was based on evidence on 2004 to 2013. That's 4 years before Kosyukov joins this conspiracy and 2 years after. So how can you sit there and say, you can just take that and say there was no plain error?
Well, we have your argument, counsel. Thank you. Thanks to both sides for the very helpful arguments. The case is submitted.